This is the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Lori Mack, in for Faith. This show is about the richness of life. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. Cell phones and now smartphones and mobile tablets have changed our world in wonderful ways, connecting us anywhere and everywhere. And time has flown. Simple cell phones are disappearing as smartphones and tablets get smarter and cheaper. Meanwhile, our communication habits are changing. According to Pew Internet reports, over 70% of Americans now prefer texting over calling. We text, check our email, Facebook accounts, our Instagram stream. We all know people who do these things more or less continuously throughout the day. And at night, our smartphones and tablets lie within arm's reach on bedside tables, sometimes glowing and dinging softly as we try to get a little recharge in before another day of communication starts. We're asked to turn off our phones at every performance, but we see the unmistakable glow in seats around us. On planes, there are passengers who need to be asked twice to power down, and they do so resentfully. To some, all of this is a way of life. To others, it's an annoyance that crosses a line. Today, we'll look at how we use our devices to stay connected and ask, do manners even matter? And joining us by phone from New York is Henry Alford. He's a humorist and journalist. His work can be seen in the New York Times and Vanity Fair. He's a contributor to NPR and the author of four books. His most recent, out in paperback, is Would It Kill You to Stop Doing That? A Modern Guide to Manners. He's been a guest on this show several times. Henry, welcome back.
Thanks, Lori.
And in the studio with me is Maggie Mahoney. She's a 16-year-old high school student from West Hartford, and she recently wrote an op-ed piece for the Hartford Current titled Time to Put Away the Anti-Social Media. It's about her generation's obsession with their devices and what social networks teach them about personal connections. We have a link to Maggie's piece in the Current, as well as more information on Henry Alford's book at wnpr.org/faith. Welcome to the show, Maggie.
Thank you.
I want to start by saying Maggie's op-ed piece points out some interesting observations, and I don't in any way mean to make light of your concerns. Sometimes poking fun gets the message across loud and clear, and so I'm thinking there's some room to have a little fun here, if that's okay.
Okay.
So, Maggie, let me ask you, and Henry, feel free to jump in at any time here to comment or ask questions. In your piece, you describe this scene in class where the teachers end their lessons and you say the students sit silently with their eyes glued to their screens, presumably checking their various social media accounts and so forth. You call it a phenomenon and say it leaves you feeling uneasy. How do you think you ended up feeling this way?
Well, I would say it would have to do with my upbringing. My parents, I would call them strict. I didn't get a phone until ninth grade, which is pretty much unheard of in today's world. And I was very resentful. I won't deny that, because all of my friends got their phones in sixth grade, fifth grade. It's just getting earlier. But now as I look back, I really appreciate what they did by not giving me a phone, because I think that it's made me a better person. And I've just found that I've stayed in touch with people and I've learned to call them and not always rely on my technology to get in touch with people. It really helped keep my relationships strong. And so I've always regarded technology as a little bit, it's like a double-edged sword.
Yes. Yeah. And so, Henry, what do you think of that picture that Maggie paints in her piece?
About this idea that
it makes
people are staring into space at the end of class?
Right.
Well, you know, there's actually a term for that psychologists have had to come up with, and it's inattentional blindness, which is when you're consumed with one activity to the exclusion of other incoming data. We've become like this race of zombies. It's like, you know, we don't notice when a deer walks in our back door and urinates on the rug. You know, we're so consumed with our screens.
Right. And I failed to mention, Henry writes a monthly New York Times column on manners called Circa Now. Henry, why are manners important?
The gist of it is empathy. So you're trying to put yourself in someone else's shoes. I think the way that we see it happen a lot in this arena that we're talking about is, you know, I think that there's a hierarchy of communications, that the most intimate, of course, being face-to-face, and then slightly less intimate email, and then less intimate than that would be, you know, a message on Facebook, and then maybe less intimate than that is, you know, maybe you're leaving a message on Farmville. But anyway, I think the idea is that, you know, that you want to meet the incoming vehicle at about the same level on the hierarchy or higher, which is to say, if someone emails you, you can't, I don't think you should be, you know, texting them back or writing a Facebook message. I think either email them back or do something more personal, like call them up or see them face to face.
So, Maggie, you say in your piece that you're aware that society perceives your generation as lazy and technology-obsessed and spoiled. I might be able to say that about me, too. Why do you think you guys are perceived that way?
Well, I think that it's just a lot about how other people perceive us. We're not necessarily... I know lots of people who... Great people. It's definitely not all teenagers are this way. I just think that... Especially in the media, sometimes TV shows portray us as kind of just attached to our technology and very, very self-centered and just contained. And that's just how we are portrayed. And so I think people subconsciously think of us that way. But when in fact, it's not always the case, although I will say that we are, a lot of us are attached to our technology.
Yeah, and I think part of that is that, you know, when you do spend a lot of time online, particularly on social media, that there is this, you know, you get a little hit of dopamine when someone likes your Facebook post or when someone responds to something you've written. It's like a little kiss from someone. And so, yeah, I think that's where this idea that millennials and teenagers are sort of pleasure seeking or self obsessed comes from. And I agree with Maggie. I think it's unfair. It's such a huge generalization.
Yeah, you know, and Henry, for your book, Would It Kill You to Stop Doing That? A Modern Guide to Manners, you traveled to Tokyo, what you call the Fort Knox of the World Manners Reserve. You interviewed Miss Manners, talked to someone who spent time in prison where manners might, you know, be the last thing you think about. But I realized in that section when you're talking to the guy about etiquette in prison that that's probably how they were able to survive respectfully in that environment.
Absolutely. I mean, you can look at the prison environment or you can look at an Edith Wharton novel and it's, you know, the same. There are a lot of the same things. The same dynamics are going on, that it's all about respect and, you know, that a person with good manners is someone who can either, you know, step outside of himself or who can hold part of himself in abeyance, that he's not pure throbbing id, but that he's someone who can put himself in the other person's shoes, whether he's, you know, a con on Rikers Island or whether he's Lady Mingott in an Edith Wharton book.
Maggie, you say it's a struggle because you're actually guilty yourself of checking Instagram and Facebook. So do you picture yourself always feeling uneasy the way you describe in class?
It is always in the back of my mind. I just think that day to day, I don't always realize how I feel about it because it's just so common. It's part of social interaction today. So it's not considered abnormal. No one really points out the issues with social media. At least at my age group, no one my age really talks about any issues with social media. So I don't think I feel uneasy in my own social environment. But yeah, I can imagine myself feeling more guilty in the future because I find sometimes when I'm happy about someone liking my post or something, then I feel a little bit superficial and I realize it's not really that important how many people like your post because half of the people don't really know you. They're just doing it out of maybe they like what you put up or they just, it's just kind of, it's meaningless, really.
So that's getting into the friendships that aren't necessarily really friendships.
Yeah, I have lots of people who will like my posts or Instagrams, and they'll they'll like them, but they're not really, I wouldn't consider myself friends with them. Maybe they're people I see in the hallways or they're my acquaintances, but we don't really talk. So it's just something that everyone does.
And I think that the next level of this kind of, I don't want to say addiction, but of spending too much time, particularly on Facebook, is that you can create false memories. This has happened to me where I walked up to someone on the street and said, hey, remember that 4th of July when we were up on your roof? And she looked at me completely blankly because, in fact, we had not been on her roof on the 4th of July. I had simply, like a week earlier, seen a picture of her on her roof on Facebook, and I had somehow, my addled mind had put myself in this situation. So it's possible that, you know, to be sort of unintentionally cyber creepy.
Yeah.
So, totally yes, agree. That's definitely obscuring the truth about friendships and experiences, right?
Exactly.
Henry, you recently wrote a piece in the New York Times where you talk about RSVPing via Facebook and Evites. It's called The Aspirational RSVP, Saying Yes When You Mean No. Can you explain?
Well, this is this idea that a lot of people are hitting the join or yes button when there's an invitation on Facebook. And they're doing it out of a, usually it's out of a feeling of, you know, they're trying to be supportive when in fact they have no intention of showing up at that event. They've gotten out of control. And yeah, people who host a lot of events, you know, whether the invitations are coming by Evite or they're putting them on social media, that, yeah, that it's become a problem now that people are saying they're going to show up and then they aren't. And you can see the result of this in that in New York, at least, there are a lot of nice restaurants that will charge you if you make a reservation and then don't show up.
Wow.
Yeah, you can pay as much as $200 per person for not showing up at a nice restaurant in New York.
So on this thing about Facebook and being invited, you know how you can see how many people have been invited and then you can see how many people have said yes. Do you ever feel like that influences your response? In other words, if you see that 56 people were invited and only 3 have said yes, does that make you want to say yes just to be supportive?
A sympathy vote?
Yes.
Sure. I've done that. Absolutely. How about you, Maggie?
Well, I would say that, yeah, I've probably done that before too. Sometimes the list of people, I'll see a lot of my friends are invited and I'll think, oh, I'll go to this because if they go, that'd be great. But I tend mostly to do a maybe just so that if I don't show up, it's not offensive. But then if I do, it's kind of a nice surprise. That's how I tend to do things. So it's not, so no one gets their feelings hurt or if I forget or something happens. So I just tend to do a maybe.
Yeah. And Henry has a whole thing about the maybe.
The maybe, right. That's a tricky, that's a little sand pit. Yeah, I think we should get that off of invitations because it lets everyone be his own bad self, just unable to commit. And then I also talked to someone who, a lawyer, who said that a friend of his sent out a save the date announcement for her birthday 4 months in advance of her birthday. When my friend didn't respond to it within a week, the birthday girl chastised him. Like, are you listening? Are you coming? What are you doing in November? Again, that's really crazy. No one operates that way.
I guess they do now.
Yeah.
This is Henry Alford. He's a humorist, author, and journalist, writes a monthly column in the New York Times. His most recent book out in paperback is Would It Kill You to Stop Doing That? A Modern Guide to Manners. And Maggie Mahoney, she's 16 years old. She's a high school student from West Hartford and recently wrote an op-ed piece for the Hartford Current called Time to Put Away the Anti-Social Media. I'm Laurie Mack, sitting in for Faith, and we've been talking about how we use our mobile devices, what that means for our personal connections, and etiquette surrounding social media. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll continue our conversation when we come back. This is a Faith Middleton Show. I'm Lori Mack, sitting in for Faith. We've been talking about how we use our mobile devices, what that means for our personal connections, and etiquette surrounding social media. I'm talking by phone with Henry Alford. He's a humorist, author, and journalist. He writes a monthly New York Times column on manners. His most recent book, out in paperback, is Would It Kill You to Stop Doing That? A Modern Guide to Manners. And in the studio, Maggie Mahoney. She's a 16-year-old high school student from West Hartford. She recently wrote an op-ed piece for the Hartford Current called Time to Put Away the Anti-Social Media. So, Henry, you and I have grown up without technology, or at least we started that way.
Yep.
And now we've got Maggie, who isn't going to remember a time growing up without technology. And I'm wondering if you think we're in that shift similar to what you describe in your book when we went from an industrial nation to a service economy, which involved, as you say, a million opportunities to foster misunderstanding and interpersonal mayhem.
It's true. No, that it just opened the field. And there's also an interesting correlation between, you know, there was a huge boom in the sale of etiquette books right before the turn of the century. And, of course, that's right when people were moving into cities in huge numbers. So there is this idea that, you know, the more that you have to interact with strangers, the more you have to think about manners. Because we all sort of know what's required of us amongst people who we already know, amongst family members and folks who live in your small town, which is not to say that, you know, you necessarily have good manners, but you know what to expect. But as soon as you get into Las Vegas, as soon as you get into, you know, some large urban area where it's you and a couple hundred thousand strangers, then, you know, suddenly all bets are off.
So I was thinking we could go over this list and I could get your reactions to things like responding to someone's voice message with a text or an email. And I know, Henry, you addressed this in the first segment.
I think you're getting demerit points if you do. Tisk, tisk.
And Maggie, do you experience that with friends? Does anybody respond to a voice message with an email or a text?
Yeah, I've occasionally seen that. My friends are pretty good with it. One of my friends, after I wrote my piece, she called me to talk to me about the piece, and she said, your article really got me thinking, and I was going to text you, and then I thought, no, I'm going to call you, because that would go completely against your article's point. And it's true. And I got a lot of support from the article, which was really great, from my friends and my parents' friends, and just a bunch of people, and it was funny because a lot of people were sharing it on Facebook, and although I loved that people liked it and enjoyed it and wanted to share that with people, I thought it was pretty ironic because it really went against the point of the message of the piece.
Here's another scenario. Go out to dinner and everyone at your table is looking at their smartphones, which is a lot like in your classroom. Do you join them? Yeah. Even if just out of sheer boredom, this would go to the inattentional blindness. What do you think?
There's a great game that some people play now in restaurants where when everyone shows up, you put your cell phone in the middle of the table and whoever reaches for his phone first picks up the check.
That's a good game.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You got to be onto that before everyone shows up, though.
Yes, yeah. Right. So how about you, Maggie? I'm sure that this definitely doesn't happen in your family where everybody's
looking. No, definitely not. We weren't even allowed to read at the table. Our family dinners are very nice. We always talk about our day and try to stay engaged with each other. But around my friends, I wouldn't say at dinner this would happen. Maybe at a gathering. Dinner's a little formal to be on your phone. Most people wouldn't, at least at my age, don't really do that. Maybe a lunch, though, I'm sure people would be on their phones. But I try not to engage in that. I try to just talk to them, try to draw them out. But I try not to look at my phone during meals and stuff.
A lot of it is context, right? That if it sort of depends. If you're with a family member who you only see once a year, then yeah, I think it's really rude. But if you're with your buddies, you know, or it's a bunch of, you know, working moms who are getting, you know, kind of emergency type emails, yeah, or they got to keep in touch with the sitter or what have you, then, you know, I think it's a much lesser sin than, yeah, I think you sort of look the other way.
How do you feel about wishing someone happy birthday on Facebook?
Sure. Why not? It's not the warmest, loveliest chocolate-dipped strawberry in the world, but it's something.
It's true. Yeah. Usually people wish happy birthday on Facebook. Sometimes you don't. You're not necessarily close enough to them that you have their phone number, so that's really the only way to get out a message. Happy birthday. Hope your day's great. So I'll do that for acquaintances, just a simple happy birthday exclamation point or something. My friends, I'll definitely probably hang out with them that day or at least call them. Sometimes for my age, a lot of what people do a lot is they'll do a post for their good friends, but it'll be a very elaborate post. Lots of like a picture collage and, you know, very long and detailed about how they love the person, hope their day is great, just to kind of be like, oh, here's some good things for you. But I think it's better to include, try to do something more personal other than that. You wouldn't probably only do the post.
I think Maggie makes a really good point. It depends who the person is.
Right.
Yeah, family or close friend, no, get off of Facebook. But if it's a colleague or, yeah, someone you don't know that well, I think that's fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
Should we text or email a thank you after a party, dinner invitation, or gift instead of a handwritten, stamped, sent through the mail thank you?
Well, my mom and dad always had us, we still do it. They always had us write thank you notes. And, you know, as a little kid, you didn't want to do that. But it's just even just a simple thank you, like, thanks for this gift. I really enjoyed seeing you. It's so thoughtful of you to think of me. It's a lot more personal, and people tend to like that a lot, and a lot more than just a simple, like, email or something. We always do that for all my family members, and then if I have a birthday party or something, I try to write thank you notes to my friends, because it's a lot nicer to receive a handwritten note. I get a lot from my grandma. She really likes to write me those notes, and it's always special for me, so I like to think of that when I write them to other people.
I think you're lucky if you get any acknowledgement. be it a hand-printed, handmade card or an email. I'm someone who buys people dinner all the time, and yeah, it's quite uncommon that anyone actually shoots me an email the next day and says, thanks so much for dinner. So, yeah, I think if you're worried about embossed note card versus email, that's a first world problem.
We've got to get you some new friends, Henry. This is Henry Alford. He's a humorist, author, and journalist. He writes a monthly New York Times column on manners. His most recent book out in paperback is Would It Kill You to Stop Doing That? A Modern Guide to Manners. And we're talking in the studio with Maggie Mahoney. She's a 16-year-old high school student from West Hartford. She recently wrote a great op-ed piece for the Hartford Current called Time to Put Away the Anti-Social Media. How about this one? Leaving your phone on the table when you're out to dinner as a way to monitor the things that are going on. Now, Henry had said under certain circumstances, like moms out to lunch looking for the emergency call. But what if it's just monitoring the goings on?
No, unless you're a surgeon, I think it's rude. And I think even if you are a surgeon, you need to preface it with some kind of remark about, I'm so, so sorry, but someone's trachea is very close to collapsing, and I need to be monitoring it throughout dinner.
Maggie, have you experienced this with your friends where everybody puts their cell phones out next to them, maybe on the lunch table or something?
Yeah, I've experienced it. Although, you know, if you're going to do that, you may as well just go full on and just hold it and look at it and stuff. I agree with Henry. I think that it is a rude thing to do, even if unless there's some sort of you're waiting to hear something important or your mom wants you to make sure to, like, call her at a certain time. I mean, but you could always explain that to the people you're with just so they don't feel like you're ignoring them or anything. I usually just keep my phone in my bag when I'm at dinner.
Yeah, and it's really easy just to take your phone into the bathroom if you have to check messages. Or if you're at the movies, you make a little cave out of your coat and you put the phone inside the cave and then Mama Bear goes in to find little baby bear. Yeah, like that.
Have you been part of those group texts? So
yes.
You're maybe one of 25 people, and someone is announcing that something great just happened, and then you continuously get these pings on your phone because everybody needs to respond. Congratulations. Oh, that's great.
Yes, that has happened to me. It happens more often with a work email where, yeah, there's 16 people, and then the person who hits reply all just to make some kind of general comment like, great. That's the digital equivalent of a styrofoam peanut. You don't need to send that styrofoam peanut out to all 16 people. Just, you know, send it to the original sender.
Sometimes I think the people who are sending out the mass emails or texts are usually doing it because they want to get a message to all their friends and stuff, but then they don't anticipate that everyone's going to respond all at once. And sometimes it's confusing on iPhones. If you don't have the person's phone number, you don't even know who's talking. It's just a huge mess, and it usually goes on for a long amount of time. And before I had an iPhone, people used to send me group messages, and that's even worse. It doesn't even work on your phone, so it's just you're getting all these messed up, and it's loading, and it will never stop loading, and it was just a huge inconvenience. So I think if they wanted to send, they could just say in their text or email, please respond individually if you're going to, because it's really not necessary to have a bunch of people talking all at once.
Yeah, and I will say that this is a lovely upside of social media, is that it has reduced the number of group joke emails.
Yeah.
That now if you see a funny situation involving a cat and a kitchen sink, that you can express that funniness in a public forum like Facebook, and then only the people who want to explore the funniness of that cat in the kitchen sink will do it, you know, rather than emailing it to 20 people.
So do we think that we should have some etiquette involved here in how we use our devices, or are we currently working on that, you think?
Oh, yeah, absolutely we're working on it, and I think it's by trial and error mostly. You know, I think that people in Maggie's generation are slowly seeing the light because of, you know, articles like the ones that Maggie wrote. And I think as soon as you get, you know, you only need to be burned once or twice in some etiquette snafu, and then I think you learn your lesson.
He just made a great point saying that you only have to be burned once or twice to kind of realize. I think that it's often you figure out, it's kind of the golden rule, treat others the way you want to be treated. It really is true. I think that you realize what you don't want to do or what you do want to do based on other people. I know I have family members who are very attached to their devices, and I'll be in their presence and they'll just be on their devices kind of ignoring me. And that especially happened when I didn't have a phone. And it just made me think I will never do that when I get technology, because it makes you feel really bad, and you realize I don't want to be that type of a person, and you kind of make that decision for yourself. So it's good to see other people's behavior and then kind of model what you're going to do based off of what you see that you like and what you see and you don't like.
Well said.
Amen.
Maggie Mahoney, good luck in school in the fall.
Thank you.
And thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, I enjoyed it.
We have a link to Maggie's op-ed piece that appeared in the Hartford Courant on WNPR.org/faith, and also Henry Alford, author of Would It Kill You to Stop Doing That? A Modern Guide to Manners. He also writes the Circa Now column for the New York Times. Henry, thank you for being on the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
This is the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Laurie Mack, in for Faith. Coming up, we revisit a conversation Faith had with Scott Stossel about his memoir, My Age of Anxiety.
I've been unwanted before, it's true, and uninvited a time or two. Today I'm feeling unusually blue. I've been unfriended by you. The hourly updates on your activities, your joys, your pain, your sensitivities, all of the parties you have attended. Ooh, I've been unfriended.
I'm Faith Middleton. Thank you so much for listening. Really appreciate it. We are hardwired for anxiety, which explains why 40 million people have supposedly said they battle it. Anxiety can range from fearing noises in the house at night to symptoms so severe, it's amazing people survive it. The most competent individual can be so stricken that he or she cannot function. The bones feel as if they are rattling with fear. The mind is blank. The panic is massive. Zero sense of control. None. Well, how do we explain what anxiety is, and why is it so extreme in some people? Science, as my guest will tell you, is working on it. He had a genetic test to check on the roots of his own staggering anxieties. What is remarkable about Scott Stossel is that despite his endless anxiety and the torture it instills, he researched and wrote a memoir-style biography of anxiety that took him 8 years. He is very candid about his own symptoms, so many and sometimes so weird that you wouldn't believe a movie that portrayed it this way. But it's real, and Scott Stossel is not alone. So many people have said that sentence, "I think I'm having a nervous breakdown." Whether you have simple anxiety or full-blown episodes, don't miss this conversation because you're about to meet one of the most fearless writers. I think one of the most fearless humans around. Here is a man who used his sometimes twisted mind to understand that twisted mind. Scott Stossel is editor of The Atlantic. He's an author, has contributed to The New Yorker, Wall Street Journal, The New York Times. Scott, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So I was thinking about this phrase, nervous breakdown, and I want to tell you something that happened to me once, and I'm doing this for a reason, not because I think I belong in the middle of this, but because I don't want to make you into a freak show.
Appreciate that.
Yeah, I bet you do. So once, this was at a time of a death, I felt as if I was having a nervous breakdown. And the feeling was, the anxiety was so crippling, and I had that zero sense of control, felt like I was rattling inside. But the key thing was, I felt like I might shatter, you know, explode into a million pieces and just not exist. That's how incapacitating that feeling was.
Well, yeah, the feeling of anxiety can be, you know, completely overwhelming. And you know, what you went through, all of us to some degree or another, or almost all of us, there's a point at which, you know, we are undergoing so much stress that you'll be overcome and you simply can't withstand it and start to break down. Some of us are more on the anxious side of the spectrum. Some have more resilience. But there's a point at which if subjected to enough external stress, your psychic defenses will start to break down and you'll start to feel completely out of control. And I appreciate your sharing that story. It's funny, I talked to a friend of mine who had written, when she read my book, she had previously written a book about being a cancer survivor in which she talks about all kinds of incredibly embarrassing personal things. And people would come up to her and start asking her all these questions. And she would say, before I can talk to you, I need to level the playing field. You need to tell me some incredibly personal story before I can even talk to you. So I appreciate your doing that.
Oh, that is so smart of her. You know, having said that, that this is going to sound like I was just trying to give myself permission to list some of your anxieties. But I want people to know that when it's extreme, this is what it can feel like. So, you know, rather than underlining sentences from your book, which I have read, and it is incredible, here's what was listed in the New York Times book review. Scott's anxieties include claustrophobia, acrophobia, aerophobia, and a mysterious fear of cheese. Also, panic attacks, a nervous stomach, stage fright. He has bolted in the middle of interviews and speaking gigs. That concerned me. He has soiled himself on airplanes. At the altar, preparing to take his wedding vows, he looked so fitful and intensely sweaty that the minister asked if he was okay. He was and he wasn't, as he fought the shaking of his limbs, quote, the urge to vomit and unconsciousness. Okay, so I don't think I've even scratched the surface with some of that. There's a lot more. This is why I say you're one of the bravest people I know. It takes amazing courage. What is that thing inside you, besides medication and alcohol, that allows you to somehow find the tiniest little perch to not let go.
Well, it's funny, you're not the first who said that this, you know, that my writing is fearless. And it's funny because I sometimes feel like, well, actually, it's the opposite. Isn't it quite fearful? It's all about my fears. But I wrestled a lot with, you know, despite suffering from this kind of panoply of anxieties that, you know, extend the range of what you just listed and beyond. I have, you know, I was first diagnosed with anxiety disorder when I was 10, and I'm 44 years old now. So I have managed, you know, to conceal it very effectively from colleagues and friends for 34 years. So I had this kind of great trepidation about, you know, coming out with this all in a book, where I, in effect, you know, come out as anxious and reveal all of my anxious symptoms and sometimes, you know, embarrassing predicaments that my anxiety causes to the world. You know, I didn't set out actually to write a memoir. What I really wanted to do was do an exploration of anxiety. But since I'm not myself a psychologist or a psychiatrist or a historian of science, what I realize is that, you know, where I have the most authority is kind of on my own anxiety. So I end up kind of using myself as a case study and sort of go on this quest to try to understand the roots of my own anxiety as a means of trying to figure out what is the function of anxiety in, you know, the human condition, what's it been like, you know, how have people thought of it in different historical periods, how do, you know, philosophers versus scientists versus psychologists think of it. So I, in the book, I end up sort of presenting myself as my own case study, and it's incredibly subjective in some ways, where I'm, you know, putting you, the reader, through what I went through, but I also try to get sort of a radical distance on it and look at myself almost as a clinical case with some detachment. And so I hope my hope was to try to convey, you know, both the experience of anxiety but also a lot of information and kind of the historical and scientific context that surrounds it.
People mistakenly think that this is about some kind of mind control. If you can just kind of get yourself together, if you say the right things, if you start exercising, I mean, there's a list. I've heard this from people endlessly. Often people who don't believe in the value of medication. And I'm just shaking my head in amazement. I think, oh, you don't know what it's like when something like this descends on you. You think that's right?
Yeah, no, I do think that's right. I mean, it is true that there are, I mean, I'm a big proponent of exercise, like my own experience, and there's a vast literature that these sort of banal things, banal sounding things like getting enough sleep and getting enough exercise actually are hugely important in keeping your overall sense of well-being and your levels of depression and anxiety down. But what you say is exactly true, that, you know, someone's in the throes of severe anxiety or having an anxiety attack, if someone just says, get a hold of yourself, you know, you can't. That's the whole point. It's almost like your mind and your body have been hijacked by this kind of physiological set of cascading reactions that you can't get out of. And it's, what a panic attack is, or severe anxiety is, in some ways, is an adaptive human response. It's the fight or flight response, but gone awry, and firing, you know, at the wrong time. I mean, if you're being chased by a saber-toothed tiger or being mugged, you know, it makes sense for you to be having this, you know, cascade of physiological reactions where your mouth goes dry and suddenly your perception becomes more acute and you start sweating and your stomach hurts and all the blood flows away from your digestive system to your limbs. And in that situation, it's adaptive. When it's happening when you're sitting on an airplane or in a classroom or on a date, and, you know, you're having all of these horrible physical sensations and you feel like you're going to pass out or throw up or that you're having a heart attack and going to die, and meanwhile your thoughts are running away from you, you know, you can't get a hold of yourself, and that's the problem.
It made me think about how movies portray this anxiety. You know, you see the sweating, you see the panic in the eyes, the face, and then the person just starts running in no particular direction, just to kind of get away, not just from the thing chasing you, but from the self.
Well, that's the problem, is that, you know, when you're at your worst, and that's sort of the difference between fear and anxiety. If you're afraid, and this is a distinction that Freud made between, you know, fear and anxiety, or between neurotic anxiety and what he called real anxiety, if you're afraid of something concrete, like a poisonous snake or a bad guy, or you can run away from it. Anxiety is often irrational, and it's often within yourself. And so that's the worst part of it all. You can't get away from it because it's inside you. And I've experienced this sort of overwhelming terror where you feel like, I've got to run, I've got to get away from this. But wherever you go, there you are.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you're better off using techniques like, you know, mindfulness meditation or deep breathing, or just trying to let the anxiety sort of wash over you and then pass.
Ah, so you mentioned mindfulness. When I think back to that, the time of the death and my response, there was no way. I practice mindfulness. There was no way that someone could have tried that with me at that moment and said, now breathe and feel where your body is at this moment. You know, all the things that we do. You know, there was just nothing to be said that was going to calm me down, short of a couple of pills.
Right. And that's the terrible irony, that things like mindfulness, meditation, or yoga, the people for whom it's most important and necessary are those people who will have the most trouble actually managing to do it. I mean, they've done these studies on, you know, really highly trained Buddhist monks who are expert at meditating, but they'll never find themselves, you know, precisely because they've managed to achieve such kind of mastery over their own mind, they'll never find themselves in a situation where they're completely feeling anxious and out of control. Whereas, you know, some of the rest of us, you can't just calm down. You have such persistent sense of agitation, and, you know, sometimes medication is the only thing that can kind of overcome the firing of your own neurons. And, you know, the really horrifying thing, I mean, I've been blessed. For me, you know, medication is a complicated thing, and I have, you know, even though I've relied heavily on it on and off for 30 years, it's been very helpful to me. But there are people for whom medication doesn't work,
mm-hmm.
and that's a terrifying thought. For me, the last resort is always I can take, you know, a pill or another pill, and eventually I can achieve a sense of sort of sedation or stupefaction that relieves the anxiety. But, you know, if you become too dependent on the medications, they won't work as effectively anymore, and you need a higher and higher dosage. They come with risks of dependency and things like that. So it's a complicated business, and there are people for whom they don't work at all from
yeah.
the start.
And if you have anxiety, the irony here is that the one thing your anxieties tell you is that the medication might not be safe. And so you're in this loop that is so tricky to deal with. Scott Stossel is on the line with me. He's editor of The Atlantic and author of My Age of Anxiety. He suffers from severe anxiety, as you can hear, these attacks, and yet he has been very brave, spent 8 years writing this honest memoir about himself, all these anxieties, kind of weird things that he can convince himself of, and what I guess has plagued all of us at one time or another to a different degree, anxiety. Here is a fascinating fact for me from your book, that almost every age considers itself the most anxious age. And I mean in terms of eras. I had been thinking, well, I bet they felt this back in the Industrial Revolution, but you've gone way further back than that.
Yeah, no, that was one of the things that was most striking to me about my research. Is I went into it thinking that because everyone talks about how anxious they are today, and it's sort of almost an article of faith that we live in the age of anxiety. But when you start to look back through previous eras, you know, every age sort of presumes to think itself the most anxious ever. So if you look back at the dawn of the atomic age right after World War II, or during World War I, or during the Gilded Age, or during, as you say, the Industrial Revolution, or during the Renaissance, or even during the late Roman Empire, you know, you read both physicians of the time and social commentators talking about how they've never seen so many anxious people and how the whole society is kind of riven by anxiety. But I do think that what all of those eras have in common, and what we have in common with our own, is that there really are certain social features of different societies that provoke greater levels of anxiety. And they're all present in the current age. And those include things like uncertainty. Obviously, we have great economic uncertainty now, but there's also, all eras of great social change where people's social roles are dramatically being, you know, called into question. And ironically, you know, the last, you know, several hundred years have provided great advances in political and economic liberty, at least in the West. And those are, on balance, net very good things. But the problem is they also come with choice actually creates anxiety. And so, you know, I realize a lot of sociologists look back at the Middle Ages, and, you know, if we had been born then, our lives would have been materially a lot worse than today. We probably would have died at an earlier age. We would have been subject to all kinds of horrible diseases, and you know, you have no choice in life. Life sounds actually rather miserable. But we probably would have been free of the kind of neurotic anxieties that plague us today, because you would have been born into the role that you would inhabit. There was no question of what do you want to do when you grow up. You were what you were born into. There was no question about who will I marry, or you know, what college should I go to, or which of 57 kinds of breakfast cereal do I buy when I go into the grocery store, which is sort of a trivial example, but one that actually researchers show, you know, does cause anxiety. So there's a sense in which anxiety is a luxury of you know, the developed world, where, you know, we have the freedom to make choices, and you know, but at the same time, all this underlying uncertainty about the economy and about all the things we see in the media, terrorism and disappearing planes and things like that, that we wouldn't have been aware of 500 years ago.
Yeah, this gets us to the nature versus nurture thing, where of course, how can environment, how you grew up, what people said around you, what events you witnessed, not have an effect on your or your overall constitution? And then there's the genes that get passed on from others who might have been anxious, or, you know, just a fluke of wiring. So don't you think, because you've taken a genetic, they have genetic tests for this now. When I read your story, I thought that something this extreme has to be a kind of misfiring. What do you think?
Yes, I think that's basically right. I mean, but it's impossible to completely untangle the relationship between nature and nurture. And I do think that at the base, anxiety as a condition, and particularly as a clinical condition, is a biologically hardwired thing that is to a large degree programmed by your genes. And some people have constellation of genes that make them, you know, more prone to anxiety, and some people make them less prone. But that's fundamentally, you know, this is a part of the human condition, and we all have it. But genes aren't destiny, and I did get myself tested, and you know, in my book, I talk a lot about the discussions I had with my therapist about, you know, when I found out the results of my test that I sort of tested in effect positive for a couple of anxious genes, and I also talk about the experience of, you know, one of my ancestors, or he was a living ancestor when I was born, my great grandfather. Was a very successful man. He was dean of Harvard College, and when he got to middle age, when he was in his 50s, he had a kind of, you know, complete nervous breakdown, and then a series of nervous breakdowns. He ended up hospitalized for long stretches of time, and so my fear is, you know, clearly I have these anxious genes. Is this my fate? And my psychologist would always say is, look, genes are not destiny. And that's absolutely true, because overlaid on top of your genes are the upbringing that you had. You know, were you subjected to trauma? What are your life and social circumstances, and a certain degree of luck? And furthermore, and you know, this is the sort of positive thing that everyone can kind of take away from this, is that, you know, nowadays psychologists and psychiatrists look at resilience is a trait they talk about as something that, you know, is that your degree of resilience helps predict how resistant you are to anxiety and depression, or how well you'll be able to recover from them if you do develop them. And resilience is also genetic, and yet it can also be learned. You can cultivate it in various ways. And so one of the messages that I try to take away from my own research is that, you know, teach yourself to be more resilient, train yourself to be more resilient.
So as you point out in your book, much of the research is inconclusive about anxiety. We know some things more clearly than we've ever known. So what's the frontier? What are we looking to?
Well, anxiety field is hugely rich and yielding all kinds of fascinating insights. I mean, most of the cutting-edge research is in a few different areas, but you kind of see a convergence here between Eastern and Western medicine, because on the one hand, there's tons of interesting findings, I mean, you know, thousands of studies a year on the neuroscience of anxiety and other forms of mental illness and just general brain mechanisms. Another area is molecular genetics, which is, again, you know, what are the constellation of genes that lead to an anxious temperament? Learning about this may actually help doctors predict which patients will respond to which medications.
Yeah.
And all of this is sort of leading to advances in psychopharmacology. But then there's also all this evidence about mindfulness meditation and hypnosis and things that are, you know, come more from the East. They're now starting to apply, you know, Western empirical style, you know, double blind controlled tests to it, and find that there's a real biological medical basis to it.
Scott, I can't thank you enough. I wish you the best, and to your family too. I really love this book. It is such an amazing contribution to life. Thank you so much.
Well, very kind of you to say, and thank you for having me on.
Scott Stossel, he's editor of The Atlantic and author of My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind. The Faith Middleton Show airs at 3 and 9 p.m. on WNPR. Check out our guest lineup and join the conversation with us and other listeners on Facebook. Just search The Faith Middleton Show. Thanks to our talented team producer Jonathan McNichol and senior producer Lori Mack. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.